Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
What is this, some kind of The Filibuster podcast here on the Nerd Party? Hello and welcome to this week's episode. We're back from Sundance, London, and we've been recruited by Task Force X to review James Gunn's The Suicide Squad, where Amanda Waller will blow our heads up through to an explosive device placed in the back of our necks. Plus, we'll be catching up on what else we've seen on the big and small screens this week. I'm your co-host, Dallas King, and with me as always is the Polka Dot Man to my Peacemaker, the Rat Catcher 2 to my Ratcatcher 1. It's Lee Hutchison. How are you this week? Recovered from Sundance?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I think probably the joy of wearing masks is you usually go to like a festival, you're mixing with all these people, seeing all these films, traveling on undergrounds, and you come away with like the festival flu. I've not come away with that this time, so I'm going to call that a huge boost.
Just the festive post-festival blues.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no, so, I mean, yeah, it was weird sort of coming back and being like, yeah. Not watching movies all day. Yeah, it was the weirdest thing though, wasn't it? That you were told to wear your mask at the at the red carpet, but not at the round table. Odd rules like that, but hey, you know, who knows? So first up is The Suicide Squad, which has been written and directed by James Gunn, following his brief cancelling by the Twitterati that saw him dumped unceremoniously and then rehired for Guardians of the Galaxy 3 by Marvel Studios. Suicide Squad is neither a straight-up reboot or a sequel, it's somewhere in between, and it sees Amanda Waller call up more imprisoned supervillains to join returning faces such as Captain Boomerang, Rick Flag, and Harley Quinn to take on a mysterious threat in the dictator-controlled island of Corto Maltese. So, Lee, were you looking forward to The Suicide Squad? It's like an inverse Social Network. It's like add a the to it, you know, it's cooler.
No, but I was kind of curious because like the reviews had been overwhelmingly positive and high from a lot of people I trusted, and it was kind of going against my gut instinct of watching the trailers going, this doesn't look very good. And I was kind of went in kind of with low expectations, but I expected them to be surpassed based on the reviews, or to be something like, oh yeah, that was pretty good. It was just, you know, mediocre marketing. And I got to the end of the movie and I just turned to my mate who enjoyed it fine enough. And I went, I think I was really bored for like nearly the whole 2.5 hours of that film. He was like, yeah, I could tell. And I think I just spent the time with like slightly restless legs, just fidgeting in my seat. And it was one of the kind of the first films I saw sort of post Sundance. And you kind of come off the back of something like Sundance where you can see films that are of varying degrees of quality. You see some really great films. Then you see things like The World is Burning, for example, and you go, well, that wasn't good. But you kind of are exposed to different things. And then you just kind of watch something like this and go, what's new and original? What's exciting about this? And, you know, I read things like, for example, people saying, oh, it was wonderfully violent and, you know, aggressive, and it brought all this kind of humor. I was like, what was violent about it? It was like, yeah, there was a lot of people blowing up, but things like that, you kind of get desensitized to after about the first 5 minutes. It's boring. And like the comedy, the little bits here and there, but yeah, like I like James Gunn movies by and large. Yeah, like the Guardians of the Galaxy are good movies. I like Slither. I like some of his sort of smaller work, like Super, I think it was called. Like, I like those films, but this was just like boring. It was just completely like, I barely remember much about it apart from the odd moments. And I do not understand how this got the rave reviews that it did.
Yeah, I mean, where did you stand on the original Suicide Squad? Because for all intents and purposes, it was, you know, one of the highlights was apparently Margot Robbie's Harley Quinn, but, you know, people found it a bit disjointed, a bit humorless. Apparently the DC didn't like David Ayer's version, so they went back in, sort of re-edited a bit, put in a few more sort of quips from Will Smith and stuff like that. So, I mean, I think part of the problem here is that, you know, people were slightly confused perhaps going in the, is it a sequel? Is it a reboot? You know, there's different characters, but there's still some of the same characters. You know, they kind of slightly address the issues of the last movie and stuff, but it felt very, I mean, this one, it felt like they were you know, took the training wheels off, so to speak. You know, with James Gunn, you know, he's got a proven track record of being able to write and make audiences care about, let's face it, lesser known characters in both the Marvel and DC universes. I think this one's pitched somewhere between, you know, sort of the more sort of family friendly Guardians, but it does have the more shocking moments, which he's shown he can pull off in the likes of, like you said, Super. There's some really sort of terrific shocks in that, and also, you know, he's proven that he can do horror as well with Slither, which is still like you said, an underrated horror classic of the last sort of I was going to say decade, but yeah, no, I think it was about 2015, so yeah, no, technically in the last 10 years. So yeah, I mean, when I watched it, I think I was kind of similar to you in that, you know, I've been reading all these rave reviews, you know, people saying, you know, it's, you know, the best DC film so far. You know, again, that's sort of middling praise if you ask me, but so I thought, well, I'm gonna watch it late night at an IMAX in London, you know, I'll treat myself, and you know, I should see it before, you know, it's completely spoiled because it was out in America. I think actually that's one thing about the film is the UK audience seemed to go like a full week without really spoiling much, but now that it's out in America, it's like, you know, the gloves are off and everyone's chucking up images and clips and stuff like that and talking quite blatantly about different character deaths and stuff like this and releasing all their interviews with James Gunn where he, you know, tries to skirt around certain things, but basically told him it was going to be a spoiler one, but just chuck it up anyway, and you know, you find out before you've even gone in who's going to die. I mean, apparently he was given carte blanche to kill off anyone that he wanted, but I mean, I think it was safe to say there's probably a couple of names that were never going to meet their maker on this one. And by the looks of the film, I mean, we can discuss it a bit later on, but it seems there was maybe even some decisions that were changed perhaps in the post-edit sort of stage as well regarding certain characters. So yeah, I mean I think I enjoyed it at the time. You know, was it an amazing film? You know, no. You know, was it an improvement on the first Suicide Squad? Yes. I think some characters got better for it. You know, Rick Flagg became slightly more interesting, but I mean, I think there was different characters that I was more intrigued by, ones I'd never really heard of, but I mean, there was certainly a couple of standouts. So I mean, for you, who were some of your sort of favorite characters, if you can remember any of them?
Yeah, I like John Cena in this, and I think, yeah, probably something like that probably falls under decisions were maybe made afterwards when they look at the end and go, we like what he's kind of going on there. Like, I liked kind of John Cena's, you know, performance in that. I know I was quite negative on him in Fast and the Furious, but this one just seemed to kind of nail his humor, and like he had the best lines in the film. And I think of that one where it was like a toilet, you know, it's like a beacon of hope, and that fake sort of American machoism I thought was taken down quite well. And also I liked the shark, that was quite good. But you know, Idris Elba, good. You know, I just don't think he's got leading man. He's just not. I always prefer him as part of an ensemble as opposed to perhaps like the leading kind of character. He was fine as well. Margot Robbie didn't leave much of an impact on this. That kind of Harley Quinn shtick has more than worn out its welcome with me. And the shark was good. Yeah, and Viola Davis did what she did with her sort of limited screen time as well.
You know, Peacemaker was one that stands out, basically a douchey Captain America who doesn't care how many people he has to kill in order to protect peace in America, which, you know, if only Steve Rogers had taken that kind of attitude. But yeah, no, there was, you know, it was this thing of, I think I've complained about it before, it was like the money machine of these franchises and stuff where things are, you know, planned out so far and ahead that, you know, in the first Avengers film, Iron Man is taking a nuclear weapon up into space, and it's like, is he going to die? Is he going to, you know, sacrifice himself to save the day? And it's like, well, no, because I know that it was announced like the week before that Robert Downey Jr. had signed on to do Iron Man 3. So, you know, you know he's coming back. And then they announced that, you know, John Cena's Peacemaker was clearly impressed on the studio execs and was getting a limited series on HBO Max. But of course, you know, James Gunn in that is sort of trying to keep his cards as close to his chest as he can be and saying, oh, well, it could be a prequel. And it's like, yeah, okay. But yeah, spoilers if you haven't seen Suicide Squad yet, but essentially there's a post-credit sting which sets up that particular TV series. I mean, I thought Idris Elba was good. I like the sort of the father-daughter relationship he had with Ratcatcher 2. I thought Daniela Melchior, I think she ran away with the movie. I think she was the heart and soul of the squad, and I think she was it's a real breakout performance from her. I think we're going to see a lot more from her in the future. And then David Dalmachian's Polka Dot Man, I thought was a very good value as well, and managed to do a lot with what particularly could have been a sort of rather one-note role, but I thought he brought a lot of pathos to it. And yes, yeah, Sly Stallone as King Shark, I think is going to be one of the most popular characters coming out of that one, who had the most violent moments, but most of them again were sort of put into the trailer, so there maybe wasn't as much shock value with him as I was expecting, because yeah, no, they'd kind of spoil some of his big moments. But yeah, Sly Stallone as a monosyllabic shark, you know, who knew it was the role that he was born to play. So, like, in terms of this, actually, one before I get into this, you sort of mentioned the Harley Quinn shtick sort of wearing off on you. I mean, where did you fall on Birds of Prey?
Didn't like it.
No,
it was one of the kind of last films I think I saw kind of pre-pandemic. I would just naturally assume I do not like the DCEU movies, and I don't say that as like I've got a grudge against them. I'm just... they're rubbish. Like, I saw a bunch of lists.
If it's
where,
not
like,
Nolan, he's out.
Yeah, just like, you know, I like some of the stuff that they've done previously, etc. But all this kind of DCEU stuff is just chronic. I mean, I saw a thing last week where someone was like, here's my lists. And, you know, everyone does these things. I do it too, where it's like, you've seen the new film. Here's my top 10 list of how I'd rank the DCEU. And I was looking at them going, God, that is a pretty atrocious list of things. Like, Shazam was fine. It was okay. That film has no right being 2.5 hours. That would be a great 90-minute film. But yeah, it's just a chronic franchise of movies, and, you know, the fans are insufferable.
Gloves are off. Yeah, no, I liked what the Birds of Prey film did with the character of Harley Quinn. I thought making her more of a sort of independent character, no, not as tied down to the, you know, being a lackey of the Joker and stuff like that. And I felt that this film kind of rolled back on quite a lot of it. I was quite disappointed with her character, you know, immediately sort of falling for a man. I mean, immediately, I know she does, you know, get herself out of that relationship in quite a spectacular way afterwards, but I thought that, you know, she was almost back into the sort of damsel in distress mode as well. And I thought it was sort of doing a disservice. James Gunn was probably writing this around about the time that, you know, it had just been the first Suicide Squad, probably hadn't really seen Birds of Prey at that moment, so was probably just basing it himself off the previous Suicide Squad film. But yeah, it did feel like a bit of disservice to her. And so in terms of the deaths, I mean, how did you feel about them? I mean, the first act is essentially, they say, you know, they're dying to save the world, you know, don't get too attached and stuff like that. I mean, how did you feel about the frequency and the choices of the character deaths in this one?
Yeah, it was fine enough. And it was one of those things, I just think it was probably testament to either the first movie or how engaged I was with this film, that none of them really impacted. Every so often something would happen, go, oh, okay, fair enough, they've killed that person off. It was like watching the first opening kind of 10, 15 minutes going, God, was that a character that was pretty important in the first one? Like, my mind was boggling. Like, it just, some of these people made no impact. But I was kind of pleased for some of these people that, you know, fair enough, they must love the project or their characters, that they would come back for such small roles and to be sort of unceremoniously dumped quite early on for a new kind of breed of characters. I kind of respected that, to be honest.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think there was certain characters, you know, were probably not going to make it past the opening salvo. And by that, I mean, basically anyone who has previously worked with James Gunn. I won't name names in case you haven't seen it, but there's familiar faces which you kind of know have come on as like a favour to him or something, just to, you know, to come on and be a superhero for a couple of minutes and then have a spectacular death scene. So, I mean, in terms of its place in the wider DCEU, which it's quite clear that I think you're never going to be a fan of. You probably will still see all the films and add them to your Letterboxd list, but will never be a true fan. But I mean, it didn't seem to really impact the wider DCEU. I mean, clearly Henry Cavill is not back on board yet properly as Superman, if he is going to be, because you know it was set up that Bloodsport was apparently in prison for shooting Superman with a kryptonite bullet. That would have made a lovely Family Guy style flashback sequence. Didn't get it. And then actually the DCEU has now reached, actually to be fair to them, they have now reached a phase in the Marvel Cinematic Universe where, you know, it's an enviable place to be, that they've got so many movies, but now that they've got so many big characters, that whenever those characters don't appear in the smaller movies, people go, I guess it's like the Pucci thing, everybody should be asking, where's Pucci? And I've already seen like articles going, where were the Justice League when this was going on? Because, you know, you think that the emergence of a giant kaiju-sized starfish, intergalactic starfish, would be enough to prompt perhaps Superman or Wonder Woman, maybe not Batman, because, you know, it's probably quite far to fly in his Batjet, you know, to turn up and try and save the day. But, you know, it's just, you know, no point is there, like, nobody's asking, shouldn't the Justice League be dealing with this rather than us? But, I mean, what did you make of the third act where it was Starro versus the Suicide Squad? For me, it felt, and I don't know if this was just because of the inclusion of Peter Capaldi, but it felt very almost Doctor Who-esque in terms of its, like, the mini starfish taking over people and things like that.
Yeah, I just found it to probably go on. It was just really boring to kind of look at. I think the film has this sort of really grey kind of cinematography that just is really unappealing. You know, all these greys and darks and so on. It just wasn't appealing to kind of look at. And yeah, you've got this big starfish and the little starfish that add a bit of colour, but it's one of these things, it's, you know, whether it's robots or something like that, it's always got to be some sort of mass-produced villains that our heroes can fight off. I mean, what I found was a bit more exciting was the fights that were going off, you know, kind of on the side, where, like, the kind of, I won't spoil it, but there's a fight going on between sort of two of the main characters that, you know, by and large ends in a slightly shocking way that's a bit unexpected. And then that would have been a more interesting kind of dramatic climax to go on, as opposed to you have that and you're like, oh, that's the dramatic payoff, and then you've kind of got this CGI fest going on in the background, which just isn't interesting enough. I would have preferred just a sort of smaller scale kind of thing that was going on. That fight was more appealing.
Yeah, no, I think that particular fight definitely had more sort of stakes, and it felt more real. Well, obviously more real because it was actually two people actually fighting each other. But yeah, no, it felt like there was more going on there in that small moment than there was with the, like you say, the giant CGI things, which are either sort of flying up in the sky or coming crashing down to the earth and stuff like that. So, and of course, yes, there's always the collateral damage and stuff like that that they try to deal with. So, I mean, the film sort of sets up that we could see more from the Suicide Squad, or certain characters may feature along the road in the DCEU. Given your feelings, is there anyone in particular that you'd be excited to see return, or will it just be ticking it off on your unlimited card?
Just ticking it off, really. Yeah, I don't want to ever watch this one again and all that sort of stuff. And I will watch the John Cena Peacemaker TV show. Like, that's, they've got me for that, but I think that's more testament to John Cena than anything in the film.
Have you been persuaded by his appearing in public in the Peacemaker costume whenever he's doing PR and stuff for the film?
I have not seen that. No. I somehow have managed to avoid that. I do need to rectify that. I could imagine him going to like the sick kids hospitals and stuff in his outfit.
Oh yeah, he's a good make-a-wish thing. But yeah, no, apparently he'll just like walk down the street and stuff in his Peacemaker outfit and try to stay in character and stuff like that. So actually, maybe don't stay in character if you're going to visit the sick kids, John. So there's been plenty more out in the last couple of weeks. What have we been watching? Well, Zola is out, and you can listen to our full review and interview with director Junixa Bravo on the A24 project. One film that we have not seen, sadly, was The Green Knight, unceremoniously pulled from UK release 2 weeks before it was due to come out. Not only would it have, is it one of our most anticipated films of the year, I think it's fair to say, but it would have made for an interesting husband-wife double bill with Augustine Frizzell's The Last Letter from My Lover. Now, Lee, you were lucky enough to speak with her recently, and you've got a bit of the interview to share with us here. Do you want to tee it up?
Yeah, well, I got a chance to speak with Augustine about her work on Euphoria and Never Going Back, and this is obviously a very different film from any of those projects. So she took us a little bit behind the scenes on sort of making the film sort of in the, well, more the post-production in sort of a post-COVID world. So here's Augustine. You've not long finished sort of shooting and The Last Letter from Your Lover, which sounds incredibly different to the work that you've kind of done before. Can you tell us a little bit about sort of this film and what kind of we can expect when it kind of finally lands?
Yeah, I mean, that movie was like my answer to the stress of Euphoria. Like my answer to the emotional like draining of Euphoria. I just wanted to do something that felt that felt like cozy and warm and like a cup of tea. It was like British and predictable and really soothing and warming. And so that's what it is. It's like a dual time period story with two incredible female leads. You've got Felicity Jones playing the modern day. She's a journalist, she's writing a story, and she comes across a letter that was written in like the mid 60s. And the letter is intriguing. It's this man asking this woman to like run away with him. And so she and the archivist at the newspaper, they seek answers and they go on a search to find out like who wrote this. And then simultaneously we're seeing the 60s version. We've got Shailene Woodley playing this woman who's come home from the hospital having been in some sort of accident. We don't know what. She's lost her memory, and she also finds a letter. And she goes to find, okay, who wrote this? It's written to her by someone who's not her husband. So she's on a search to find out who wrote the letter and what her life was like before she lost her memory. She doesn't really know much about what she'd been up to. And then the third element is we get to watch Shailene meet Callum Turner and have this wild, passionate love affair, and the three are interwoven. I mean, I say it's like simple, it's not like the thing was a beast, like three different storylines, two different time periods. Like it was really not a simple film to make, but I think that when people watch it, it should feel like effortless and really cozy and warm.
You finished obviously shooting not long before sort of COVID hit. How has kind of COVID and lockdowns affected sort of like the post-production and sort of the potential release of the film?
For post, it just, you know, when lockdown in London hit in March, so we started editing in January, March lockdown happened. I flew home to Dallas almost immediately and we just edited afar from this amazing software called Evercast, which I love. And that's really the main way that it caused disruption is that we were just remotely working. But then I think what happened after we got to a certain point in the edit was we needed to do a test screening so we could figure out what else needed to be done. And we couldn't do one for a while just because theaters weren't open. So everything hinged on, okay, we're gonna go on hiatus. We'll resume post-production once we can have a theatrical test. And so that happened in September. Everything opened back up in London. They immediately booked like two screening rooms at a theater in Wimbledon. And we just kind of held our breath being like, how many people are gonna sign up? How many people are gonna wanna go sit in a theater and watch a film they know nothing about? And miraculously, every seat was full with social distancing. So normally you just have one screen. We booked two so we could have the same amount of people, but socially distanced, like seats between. And it was incredible. Like I didn't know what to expect. I'd never done a test screening and people were just in it. And I still don't know if it's an effect of having been locked up for months and needing to get out and be at the theater, but they were just laughing and they were like cheering, and like there's a moment when they were all just like collectively like gasped at this like discovery, because the movie's kind of like melodrama in some ways, and they were just like fully engaged. It was so exciting. And I still don't know if that's COVID or the film. Hopefully it's a little bit film too, when they actually like will like it at home. But that's kind of how it affected post. And then we were like, oh damn, okay, we've got a good movie, we're just gonna get the little pickups that we'd already planned on getting. And so we did 2 days of pickups in London, and the real difference there was just, you know, masks, sanitizer and hand washing stations everywhere, which is amazing, and I love that, because everyone has clean hands. And you also don't have to like touch people. Sounds awful, but I'm not a handshaker. I'm like a waver. And so it's nice that no one expects it anymore.
So yeah, and you'll be able to listen to the full interview on the A24 project. Lee, like you said, I think it's fair to say that if you have seen her previous work in A24 in terms of Euphoria and Never Going Back, this is a very different film, based on a Jojo Moyes movie. It stars Felicity Jones as a writer for a London newspaper who is researching a story when she comes across a series of postbox marked envelopes and letters that hint at a secret love affair between two people in the 1960s. And she sets out to try and track down the authors of these letters. So basically we get two simultaneous plots where she's trying to work out the truth behind the letters, and then we also get what's happening in the 60s, and that stars Shailene Woody and Callum Turner as the star-crossed lovers. So Lee, what did you make of this one? Were you going to see this one purely based on the director, or was it something that you were burning to see?
No, based on the director, really. And I think we're in this sort of weird limbo period now at the cinema where there's not much coming out that's necessarily original. It's like you've got your kind of Jungle Cruises, The Suicide Squad. I was just looking at the listings for Friday, and it's like, where's the new films? Where's the smaller films? Where's like the things that would get me kind of excited? Like, I don't mind going to see a big screen movie, but I like to pepper these things in with other things. So we're kind of in that limbo period where it's like, anything slightly different or new, I'm quite keen to see. No, but by and large, it was because I liked Never Going Back a bit more than yourself. And obviously, I was really interested in Augustine's direction, especially after Euphoria, to see what she would do with something that's very British. You know, she's someone that is very American. So it's always interesting to see how people come to that. But I find it an enjoyable enough movie, really. It's one of those things, I think the performances are good. There's nothing by and large original about it, but I think that would probably apply to most Jojo Moyes books, I can imagine. I just thought it was quite interesting to see sort of how an American adapted something like this. It is a very idyllic version of London and Londoners. It's, you know, it's almost in this weird sort of hyper reality where it's a London that only exists in these sorts of trashy kind of books and so on. So it was interesting to just watch it as an exercise. But as like a film, it was like, yeah, that was like less than 2 hours. It was something a bit different. I thought the performances were fine. It has a nice ending. Sometimes that's enough for, like, we're having it at the moment where it's like just the worst weather where it seemed to be imaginable. Watching this on a kind of rainy day just felt quite nice.
Yeah, you wanted to be on the French Riviera, I guess. Some very beautiful sunsets over there at that point. For me, I maybe wasn't as convinced. I think the performances are very strong. It's great to see Shailene Woody in this. Felicity Jones does a lot with what potentially could be quite an unlikable character. She's sort of very sort of self-centered at the beginning, but then sort of gets to soften and mellow. I guess she's sort of maybe taking some lessons from the romance that she's reading about here. For me, I felt it did feel a little disjointed, where there was a lot of focus on the 60s storyline, and maybe some of the cutting back and forth could have been worked into the plot slightly better, maybe with the discovery of letters and she starts reading it and then sort of goes back and forth there. But I think the sort of romantic plot line in the current in the now sort of period was maybe sort of slightly underbaked and underserved by the amount of time that they got together. I thought. But yeah, it was a pleasant enough movie. And I mean, certainly by the looks of it, means I guess Jojo Moyes is perhaps the British version of Nicholas Sparks, I guess. I'm looking at the posters are probably the ones where it's got two people sort of looking directly at each other with, like you say, a French Riviera sunset or something behind them and looking all like, wouldn't you just love to be here? As opposed to in the London version of it, where they're just continually getting rained on and stuff like that. Although I did notice that the ending for this film did seem, it's like, has someone been watching Four Weddings and a Funeral recently?
Yeah, I can't. I've not watched that movie in decades, so that moment completely passed me by.
Is it raining? I hadn't noticed. No.
Ah, yes.
But of course, it's very difficult to probably, you know, film a romantic scene in London at the moment without it raining. So there you go. One other film which we have definitely both seen. I mean, it was I think we had to, given the Twitter discourse and the Twitter memes coming off of it. I was able to squeeze it in just before Sundance. I think you caught it up with it afterwards, and that was M. Night Shyamalan's Old, which is a story about a group of people who go to a idyllic island for a holiday and get told about a lovely beach, secluded beach that they can go to and have a lovely picnic. But it turns out that they then can't leave the beach, and time works very differently on this beach, and they get old, very, very old, very, very quickly. And yes, I think it's safe to say that when I was watching this film, and it starts with you know, a family driving up to the hotel, and one of them sort of complaining, "Are we there yet?" And it's like, "Oh, quiet, you've got your whole life ahead of you." I was like, "Oh, okay." And it's like it reminded me of that Garth Marenghi meme, where the quote where he says, "I know writers who use subtext and they're cowards." This was basically going to be all its cards out on the table. Yes, I'm going to make essentially a horror mystery about the fear of aging. And some people like it, some people hate it. It is rather crazy. But what did you make of it?
I liked it. I think it kind of helped that I hadn't seen the trailer for it. So in like the first 72 hours of this meme, like about the beach making you old, I was like, what the hell are people talking about? Similar to recently, where the people were talking about the whole shirt thing, like the more expensive a shirt, like the better, like the more complex the pattern. I was like, I have no idea what people are talking about. And then I watched the episode of I Think You Should Leave, and I was like, yep, I get that. Very funny. Yeah. So like with this, it took me a couple of days, and I kind of was like, I'd heard mixed reaction, but I was relatively keen to still go and see it anyway, because it's M. Night Shyamalan. And yeah, I think having not seen the trailer helped, because like I knew that the beach made people old, but I didn't expect it to go in the direction it did. I mean, some spoilers here, like at the film, by and large, something like Suicide Squad, you sign up and you're like, I know 100% the film I'm getting here, like I know how this will roughly end, and you know, it takes care of itself. With all those, like, I was kind of guessing to the end, going, right, what's the twist going to be? Where's the climax going to be? But along the way, it was peppered with enough, like, absolutely weird batshit decisions that I was like, wow. Like, there's a bit where, like, spoilers, where kids that are about, like, 6 or 7 age to about teenagers, and then they're kind of flirting quite a bit in a tent, and you're like, all right, is this maybe going that direction? Okay. And then, like, minutes later, the person's pregnant and goes through an accelerated pregnancy, and it's like, holy hell, I did not anticipate this whatsoever. And I like to be surprised by, like, a big mainstream blockbuster. And, like, Old did, by and large. Like, I think the logic and the aging kind of doesn't quite match up with what would be the reality. It all seems a bit all over the place. But it was so silly, and it kept me engaged as an audience member, that it got a big pass mark from me.
Okay, yeah, no, I think actually I think it would have been, yeah, I'd seen the trailer, so I sort of knew roughly what was coming in terms in certain plot beats. I mean, the pregnancy and stuff is revealed in the trailer as well, so but yeah, no, I mean, I still, I mean, it's one of those sort of, like, you could see it sort of like a so bad it's quite entertaining sort of film. I mean, the dialogue is so incredibly on the nose and cheesy and stuff at times, but I think it helps that you do have certain actors like Rufus Sewell and Thomas and Mackenzie, and sort of Vicky Cripps from Fat Head. It's like they sell the material, you know, they're treating it like it's, you know, Shakespeare or something like that, which means at times it can add for maybe some unexpected humor and stuff like that. But overall, you know, I mean, it was an interesting way to pass the time. Like you say, I mean, the logics and the physics of it don't really match up. It's like the children need to eat a lot because they're aging, their bodies are still growing, but none of the adults seem to eat anything. And you'd think that if your body was aging, you would need sustenance in terms of water and food and stuff like that. But I mean, it's just one of those things. It's just, we'll just park that to the side and hope nobody, you know, questions it during the film. They can talk about it all they want once they get into a tasty debrief or onto a podcast, and they can pick it apart all they want, but during the film, hopefully the people won't really notice that. But I mean, yeah, it's Walking Goes, and like you say, you, because it's M. Night, you know, you are sort of expecting a twist, and you are expecting almost perhaps a more positive resolution than perhaps we get in this. I mean, there's one point where one of the characters ages up and sort of comes out from a cave, and the actors, Em and Elliot, but I for a second thought, how did they get Stanley Tucci in this? I couldn't believe it. I just thought it was Stanley Tucci. But I mean, the ending, it was like, okay, that's interesting. I can kind of see, yeah, no, that kind of makes sense that, yeah, that particular company would do that. Yeah, no, it kind of makes sense that, yeah, no, I'll buy that as a sort of Twilight Zone-y type reason. But then you've got like an extra sort of twist on at the end, and yeah, we're not going to spoil it for that. But yeah, no, I mean, I thought it was enjoyable in a sort of really bad sort of cheesy way for me. And yeah, I mean, M. Night's an interesting one. You know, he got a lot of stick for this sort of when it came out, but you know, I think he's proven to have the last laugh. You know, he's essentially sort of the modern day George Lucas, and that, you know, he's financing all of his films himself. And I think this one had a budget of like something like $15-20 million, and it's already sort of made that back already. You know, he knows how to turn a profit and stuff like that. People will slag him off, you know, say that his films are bad, you know, that they've got obvious twists or unobvious twists, but they've always got twists and stuff. But people still go see them, and you know, it was number one in the box office in America. So you know sometimes, you know, he can do great things, you know, such as like Unbreakable, Split, less so Glass. I think I was one of the few people who kind of appreciated what he was going for, but it did turn a lot of people off. I've seen a lot of people sort of reappraising The Village recently for some reason. I don't know if it's had an anniversary or something, but a lot of people have been talking about that recently. That's one that I'd like to revisit. I think again, the twist is like one which is so out there that you think, how can he get away with this? But I think up until that point, I thought it was quite a well-made film. I mean, where do you stand on his back catalogue at the moment?
Yeah, it's always a bit mixed. I've always liked the Village. I went to see that at the cinema, and you know, obviously the twist wasn't the most shocking in the world, but it was a good movie as far as I recall, like, what, 20-odd years ago, give or take? Signs was one of my favourite experiences in the cinema. I like The Sixth Sense. I'm a bit torn on Unbreakable. You know, Split was good, Glass was all right. Yeah, it's one of those things, like, he's someone that's well worth kind of checking out every couple of years when he releases a film. And I'm the same as you. I have so much respect for his thing of, like, he is just funding these movies himself. And that's something so rare in this type of realm of making kind of bigger budget movies, if that makes sense. Like, he's got that indie filmmaker sensibility, and if you kind of lined him up with any other sort of like indie distributor, whether it's like a Neon, A24, Annapurna, whatever, his ratio probably is in line with their hit ratio, so hit success. So yeah, I all power to him. That we need more people like that.
Absolutely, you know, he's the one, you know, it gives him complete creative control. You know, people won't always like his movies, but he's making the movies that he wants to make. And it sort of ties into this whole thing of recently, you know, people complaining that Suicide Squad didn't do well at the box office in America. It seems to actually have done pretty well overseas, but you know, we are in the middle of a pandemic. You know, it was also on HBO Max and stuff like that, so you know, people are still need to give a bit of leeway for results not being as they should. But there was an interesting thing that came out. I'm not going to get into the whole Stillwater plot and how it relates to certain true life events and stuff like that, but I think Matt Damon was on the Hot Wings Eating show, and he was talking about an interesting thing about these mid-budget movies where you don't see them anymore because of essentially the streaming market, because it's basically taken over from the DVD and the home rental market, where a movie that he might have done some, you know, in the sort of mid-noughties or whatever, where it, say, had like an $80, $90 million budget, you could afford not to make all your money back at the cinema because you knew that you had a second dip at that when it came out on DVD and Blu-ray and stuff like that. So with that market shrinking down, where people don't release their movies on DVD or Blu-ray, or may only release it on DVD or on Blu-ray if it reaches a certain amount at the box office, that people aren't really getting to make those movies because there just isn't the market to make it back at the moment. So that is a shame, and so that's maybe why we do need more filmmakers, I guess rich, self-financed filmmakers who are able to take a risk, make original projects and stuff like that, which, you know, then stems the tide against all these multiple franchises and stuff like that, which I guess we're going to see over the next couple of years, you know, once, I guess now that cinemas are nearly back to full capacity, what's Bond going to do? You know, are they going to make their budgets back? I mean, I think we're going to still see the end of like $250 million, $300 million being made, spent on a movie. Apparently Bond needs to make at least $900 million to break even. I think the math is slightly odd on that one, but I think it's because MGM and another company are sort of split in terms of what they put into it. So basically, in order to get their money back, they needs to make about $900 million. Dune, I know a lot of people are shaking in their boots because it will probably be like one of the best critically acclaimed films of the year. It'll be fantastic to watch, but potentially do zero at the box office, a la Blade Runner 24.
Yeah, I love that. You know, Matt Damon had a hell of a week last week. So, you know, he did quite well with his point about that, but maybe he should have kept his mouth shut or just thought about what he was saying about some
with people
things.
Coming back after a pandemic and just, you know, he was great at the beginning of the pandemic talking about, you know, being trapped in Ireland and stuff like that. And there's a movie to be made about a movie star being trapped in Ireland during the pandemic while filming and stuff like that. But yeah, I don't know what it is about these stars who say things that they shouldn't, or talk about their showering habits or lack of showering habits. It's like, I don't know what's gotten to people. Have they just gone stir crazy at home and they just got no filter whatsoever?
Yeah, it's truly bizarre. I was really loving his point, and it's so true, you know. You know, unfortunately, that's just an environment that's not really catered for at the moment. You know, that's why people probably enjoy film festivals and kind of diving into movies like from A24, Neon, etc., because it appeals to that era when they kind of grew up, that low budget 80s movie, that slightly mid budget, you know, early noughties movie that Miramax probably would have pumped out. You know, they're the only people that are scratching that itch at the moment. And I thought he made a fantastic point. I mean, the whole system is absolutely, you know, ruined at the moment in terms of making money back. But unfortunately, I have to say, I don't have a lot of pity sometimes for Hollywood. I mean, think something like Suicide Squad, ridiculous budget, and it's got to make X amount of money to make it back. And it's like, but a movie like that was never going to make its money back. And, you know, a lot of the times these things are being set up to fail. Like, throwing money at a thing isn't a guaranteed solution of being a $1 billion hit. I mean, just look at Joker, for example. So small scale from DC, and it absolutely banged. It made over $1 billion, which none of the other DCEU movies did. So the idea of just throwing money at things will have to eventually be reconsidered, and they should maybe invest in those kind of lower scale movies, because this current model is not going to work. And even when COVID, you know, the restrictions ease, it's still going to be a while before a lot of films make it. I think Bond will. I'm confident in that. You know, but it will take time, and something like that always comes with a guaranteed DVD, Blu-ray market because of the collectors and the people that like to see a Bond film and want to watch it over Christmas, etc. Like, Bond will be fine.
So you're stating now on the record on this podcast that Bond will be the first film post-COVID to break $1 billion at the worldwide box office?
It will make over 900 million. I will start at that point. Yeah, I think it'll make its money back. But it will, yeah, it will be, become a hit in time, you know, budgetly. So yeah, I'm backing myself.
It might
take
10 years, but it will make 900 million.
Yeah, unlike Return of the Jedi, which is still to make its money.
Okay, so yeah, you heard it here first. So if you want to, you know, come back at the sort of November time once Bond has either made or not made $900 million and come on and attack Lee on social media, where would they be able to find you?
You can find me on Twitter at LeeHutchison_, and you can find me in my local cinema just constantly booking out James Bond as much times as I can on my unlimited card. Maybe I'll go, maybe I won't go all those times, but I will make sure that budget is just creeping up to that billion so I can say I told you so.
Supporting local cinema, that's what you do.
Yes.
And you'll be able to find me on Twitter at DallasKing1138. We'll be back next week when we're going to have a preview of the return of the Edinburgh International Film Festival. And then the week after, it's our bumper censor episode as Kim comes back to join us to discuss the horror film of the year. And we also have an interview with the director, Prano Bailey Bond. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.